Today we are on the case of William Hunsaker versus the People. May I have any further appearances, please? First for the petition.
Robert Mueller, appearing for the petition, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller.
Your Honor, Captain Ellison, appearing for the respondent.
Ms. Ellison, thank you. Counsel, this is a one-hour case. That means each of you have a half an hour. Mr. Mueller, that means you need to keep track of your own time if you wish to reserve anything, please. And whenever you're ready, you can go ahead and start, Mr. Mueller.
May it please the court. My name is Norman Mueller. I represent the petitioner. When Mr. Hunsaker was sentenced in 2006, there were a lot of unanswered questions about sex offender sentencing law. We still have some of those unanswered questions. One of them is presented today. But back in 2006, the main debate before the sentencing court was whether or not this was an extraordinary risk crime and what was the range for a potential for the minimum sentence. Nobody debated that it was going to be an indeterminate life sentence, but the debate primarily before the sentencing court was what is the range for the minimum end sentence and whether or not there were any limitations on that. Because back in 2006, this was prior authority. The Court of Appeals had ruled in Benzor, but this court had not yet issued its opinion in Benzor. And the defense position was that the minimum sentence was the midpoint presumptive range, and that the midpoint presumptive was the presumptive range, not enhanced by an extraordinary risk crime range. The district attorney argued, no, it is an extraordinary risk crime, and two, there is no limit on what the minimum end sentence could be. I believe the quote was, you can impose a 96-year sentence to life if you want for it. And the court ruled unequivocally that this was an extraordinary, and we're talking about the pattern offense because we are talking about count two, ruled that it was an extraordinary risk crime, and that the range, therefore, was enhanced. The presumptive range governing the presumptive sentence went from four to 12 years, the normal range for class three felony, four to 16 years. The court then imposed the maximum presumptive sentence using the enhanced extraordinary risk range of 6 years, of 8 years on count one, up from the 2 to 6 normal presumptive range, and then on the count two, imposed a 16-year sentence, which was the top presumptive number for an extraordinary risk crime. After Mr. Hunsaker's appeals were unsuccessful, by that time, Tillery had been decided, and it was clear that the sex offenses were not extraordinary risk crimes. This court had also issued its decision in Benzor, which I'm going to talk about in more detail later, but essentially ruled that the presumptive sentencing scheme, the ranges that we have applied to sex offenses for the minimum end sentences. So we filed a motion saying both of Mr. Hunsaker's sentences were illegal, both were minimum extraordinary risk sentences, and that was illegal if there were not extraordinary aggravating circumstances. And there's never been an argument that there were any statutory extraordinary aggravating circumstances, with the exception of the crime of violence issue, which is what I'll eventually turn to. The district attorney confessed error and agreed that on count one, there had to be a resentencing because it was not an extraordinary risk crime. There were no extraordinary aggravating circumstances. So we knew from the beginning that there was going to be a resentencing hearing, and there was never any argument that there didn't have to be a resentencing hearing because that was the only way to address that illegal sentence. The question then arose, what about count two? The district attorney argued and argues today, and the Court of Appeals agreed, that count two was not illegal. because in the pattern offense, there is the incorporating language, sentencing shall be in accordance with the crime of violence statute. And therefore, that is basically a mandatory aggravating factor. You can go up to the twice the presumptive range for the minimum end sentence. And we don't need to have, and indeed, the district attorney argued, we can't have a resentencing on count two. District court disagreed, and without discussing the various procedural missteps that led us to a final sentencing hearing, the court ruled and imposed new minimum sentences on both count one and count two, and following just what the sentencing court had done, and we had a different judge, the post-conviction judge then imposed sentences of 6 and 12 years to life concurrent, and both of those sentences were top-end presumptive sentences. Now, the Court of Appeals ignored that crucial fact, the crucial fact that neither the sentencing court, and remember, the sentencing court was faced with an argument that you can impose any number on the minimum end sentences. The sentencing court ruled that the appropriate sentence was the top-end presumptive sentence, using the incorrect range, as we've discussed. But that was what the sentencing court did. And the post-conviction court did the same thing.
Could I ask you one question there?
Yes, sir.
About the record, because I was confused at first about what the post-conviction sentencing court did, the resentencing court, because the written order seemed to be different from ultimately what he said at the hearing, when you got a hearing and resentenced. And I just wanted to get your reaction to this. Initially, it looked to me like the resentencing court was taking the position that the initial sentencing court had sentenced to the highest presumptive range sentence that court thought was allowed. But by the time the resentencing court actually imposed a sentence, it looked to me like he said, I can't really tell that. And instead, I'm just going to consider, I can't tell the reasons why the initial sentencing court sentenced to 16 years. Maybe that court thought it was because that was the top of the presumptive range. Maybe it had other reasons. So I'm just going to resentence based on everything. I've read the whole record. I'm just now going to impose a sentence. And then he imposed a 12-year sentence.
You're right, Justice Coates. I mean, I think that is what the resentencing, the post-conviction court held. I argued that it was pretty clear that the judge, just imposed top-end presumptive sentences. And there was the sentencing court did, in fact, talk about what is the proper presumptive range, and then impose, the number came out as the top number. But I do think, because we had filed the alternative motion, we had asked for reconsideration, and our position was, and it's really the first issue before the court, is can there be resentencing on count two? If there has to be a resentencing on count one, and our position obviously is the entire sentence is illegal, we can't have this there's no judicial economy coming back and saying, okay, you can only deal with count one, because the sentence as a whole, meaning the trial judge, the post-conviction court, they were considering both counts. They were going to be concurrent sentences, and count number two was really, the governing one, because it was going to, in all likelihood, be higher than count one, unless we could convince the court to, impose a lower sentence, which we tried. So I agree with you that when the court actually got to the sentencing, we put on a sentencing hearing. We put on what we felt was a compelling case that Mr. Hunsaker should, number one, be given probation. Not only because he had an exemplary institutional record, but because he had incredible families and community support. And by that time, trial judges were starting to recognize the dysfunction of the sex offender sentencing system at DOC. Mr. Hunsaker had been incarcerated for 7 years, not one day of treatment. And our argument was he can be treated better and more rapidly if we can get him out in the community. And he's already done 7 years. He's done a punitive portion of his sentence. So we presented all of that, Justice Coates. And the net effect is You know, I was disappointed because we ended up with a top end presumptive sentence. But, you know, there's no doubt that, I guess I agree with you that it was, that when we got down to the sentencing hearing, the judge took all those factors into consideration. And I was arguing for probation. We were arguing whether the court could impose probation. And I believe the court said, it's been a long time, but I believe the court said that, you know, he was still going to impose a sentence, and even if he could impose probation at this point, he wasn't going to. But I think we presented what we thought was that compelling case.
So you're saying preserve the discretion of the judge that has to do resentencing, everything needs to be open up.
Yes.
You can't confine the exercise of the discretion as to what the sentences actually turn out to be on the resentencing.
Well, I mean, there are certain limitations.
The statutory limitations.
The statutory limitations.
But within that, the discretion of the judge, who may be a different judge after all.
Exactly. And, you know, as having been doing this for a number of years, I mean, I get frustrated if a trial judge just in rote after 7 years or 8 years doesn't want to look at what has happened and look at it anew and exercise that judge's independent judgment. Because there's been a lot of passage of time. There have been developments. And I think this court has made clear under 35B law that the trial court can consider all of those factors with that passage of time, including what has happened in the institution.
And appreciating that, there was just one slight nuance that I was looking for in the question, and that is the resentencing judge, though, not only resentenced considering all these factors, and it obviously then did give what it considered to be the high end of the presumptive sentence, but it also found, didn't it, that it could not determine that the initial sentencing judge had given the 16-year sentence solely for the reason that it was the top end of what it considered to be the presumptive range.
I think that is what Judge O'Dell found. I mean, I think he made that statement, yes. So once we get to, and let me just summarize, under label, we think, and I think the law is clear, that once there is going to have to be a resentencing, and that was the solution under count one, the court could and should and needed to resentence under count two and consider all the factors. If we get to the substantive question about this confluence of the three statutes, the three sentencing statutes that govern sex offender sentencing, I think Benzer is our roadmap. First, we look at the indeterminate sentencing statute, and all of this is in Title 18, Article 1.3, so I'm just going to, if I can remember their numbers correctly, I'm going to try to refer to just the section numbers. So in 1004 is the indeterminate sentencing scheme, and as Justice Coates pointed out in Benzer, this is a return. You know, I've done this long enough. Some of us in this room have done this long enough. We started with indeterminate sentencing back in the 70s, and then we went to the determinate sentencing scheme. And now, with regard to sex offenses, we are back to indeterminate sentencing scheme. But importantly, the stated legislative purpose of that statute was lifetime supervision, not lifetime incarceration. And as this court recognized in Benzor, it was not to treat sex offenses more harshly or punish them more harshly than other felonies of the same class, but to provide for this lifetime supervision. So for class twos, threes, and four sex offenses, we have X to life. And the question is, where does X start? Where does that minimum end sentence start? And in the sex offender sentencing law, 1004, we know, first of all, there can be no mitigated range sentence. If there's going to be a sentence, it must be the minimum presumptive range. Probation is still a possibility, unless it is a statutory crime of violence. It says, as defined in the crime of violence statute, section 406. So if we, and this crime, the pattern offense, is not
what I'm going to call the statutory crime of violence. If you take the definitions in 406, what are the crimes of violence? Well, for certain set of offenses, including sex offenses, they are those that inflict serious bodily injury or involve use of a dangerous weapon. Not the case here. Then we look at subsection 2B, I think it is, as to there's an expanded definition of what sex offenses qualify for statutory crimes of violence, as defined in the crime of violence statute. And what is it? Bodily injury or use of force, threats, and intimidation. Again, not the case here. So this is, the pattern offense is not a statutory crime of violence. It doesn't meet the definition under 406. So the question is, what does it mean when the pattern offense says you shall be sentenced in accordance with the crime of violence statute? Well, the answer is that it means that the minimum presumptive sentence when the sentence is imposed is not, I'm sorry, the bottom end sentence for the indeterminate sentence is not the minimum presumptive sentence, which is what's provided for in 1004. It is midpoint presumptive, which is what's provided as the minimum sentence for the bottom end in the crime of violence statute 406. And I will tell you, as I've worked on this case, it makes my head hurt to keep jumping back and forth to all these statutes. But this construction makes absolute sense. And what I really think is an important point for the court to look at is if you look at subsection 1A of the crime of violence statute, that is the language where it says, if there is a statutory crime of violence, as defined over here in subsection 2, the sentence shall be mid-range presumptive to twice the aggravated sentence. That's what the minimum sentence is going to be. And that's essentially the district attorney's argument. That's essentially, although it's a little unclear to me, what the Court of Appeals found, is that that is the governing language. The minimum sentence can be midpoint presumptive to twice the aggravating range. No other findings necessary. Ignore the presumptive sentencing scheme in section 401, and that's your governing presumptive range. But if you look at subsection 1B, which was added when the indeterminate sentencing law was passed, which deals with sentencing for crimes of violence or sex offenses, it says the sentence shall be midpoint presumptive to life. It doesn't have that added clause.
Doesn't it say at least midpoint presumptive?
It does say at least midpoint presumptive, but it doesn't have the additional language to twice the aggravated range. And that makes perfect sense because you already have a life sentence at the top end. And so the legislature essentially was creating a new presumptive range for those sex offenses that are to be sentenced in accordance with crimes of violence, which are not in themselves statutory crimes of violence, of 8 to 12 years for the Class 3 felony instead of 4 to 12 years. And that is also consistent, I think, with what this court held in Venzer, which is, and we quoted the language and I won't quote it again, but that this court held that the presumptive sentencing scheme is still there. I mean, the minimum, the bottom end sentence is still to be governed by the presumptive sentencing scheme. And in this case, there's no doubt that there's no extraordinary aggravating circumstance. We have a sentencing court and a post-conviction court, and the post-conviction court, as Justice Coates pointed out, had a full-blown sentencing hearing imposing a 12-year sentence minimum, which was the top end of the presumptive range. Didn't make me happy, but that was the sentence imposed by the court. And the Court of Appeals jumped in and became a sentencing court and ordered reinstated an aggravated minimum sentence.
Counsel, I'm sorry, over here. If I could have you respond to the Court of Appeals analysis of that very point, saying that the 1B provision is actually ambiguous because it doesn't really provide an upper end to that, what X is. Obviously, the bottom end of X is the midpoint of the presumptive range, but it doesn't provide an upper end. In your view, that upper end would be the maximum presumptive range. So in this case, 8 to 12. The Court of Appeals seemed to think, well, it's ambiguous, and if you sort of trace the history or the evolution of these sentencing provisions before this current scheme, it was consistent with all other crimes of violence, so that it would be midpoint to 2 times the max presumptive range. So I just wanted to get what your take is on the Court of Appeals' view of or response as opposed to your statutory analysis.
Well, I think there are two responses. The first is that argument, I think the Court of Appeals conflated, and I think the district attorney does that here when they cite subsection 1A. They say, this is a crime of violence. And I think one of the labeling issues that has arisen is when the issue of per se crime of violence, which is the shorthand that has been used by courts for when a statute says sentence in accordance with the crime of violence statute, I think that has created some confusion, because I think judges are saying, oh, crime of violence. And so they are automatically applying the crime of violence statute, even if that offense doesn't meet the definition of crime of violence. So I think, number one, the Court of Appeals just, you know, fell victim to that and said, okay, we're going to treat this as a crime of violence. In accordance language means treat it exactly the same as crime of violence. And there are obviously problems with that, because it incorporates the incorporation language incorporates the entire statute, including the definitions. And this crime, the pattern offense, the facts of this offense, do not meet the definition of a crime of a statutory crime of violence. And the second thing is that it ignores Venser's opinion that we aren't going to treat, sex offenses are still going to be subject to the presumptive sentencing scheme. And when the legislature said increase the bottom end sentence from minimum presumptive to midpoint presumptive, that's all they said. They didn't say up to twice the presumptive range, as they did in 1A. They could have made that explicit. So that's why I think the Court of Appeals is.
So, Mr. Mueller, what then is the significance of any of the what we used to call the carry language in the statute defining the pattern offense? What function does it serve then, if not to ultimately say that this should be subject to mandatory sentencing, irrespective of what's happened under 1004?
Well, I think the in accordance language does a couple things. I said, number one, under subsection 1004, the minimum sentence would have the bottom end sentence. Sorry, I keep saying minimum, I'm mixing these terms up. The bottom end sentence would have had to have been minimum presumptive. So number one, it elevated it to midpoint presumptive. Number two, I think this is maybe not resolved yet, but it eliminated the notice requirements. The other thing about crime of violence statutes is you have the plead and prove requirements. And what the Terry cases have said, you were on notice. The notice is given in the statute itself. You shall be subject to sentencing in accordance with. Now, understand, in the Terry cases, I mean, I might have an argument with you, Justice Hood, someday as to whether that would apply to a pattern offense. But I might lose that argument. And why? Well, in the Terry line of cases and in the other cases, the court was pointing out that the elements of the offense overlap the elements of the crime of violence statute. You know, there's serious bodily injury, there's use of a deadly weapon. Here we have expanded for sex offenses, a bodily injury or force threats and intimidation. So I think that's number two. And then number three.
But number three.
No, go ahead.
Well, you're just saying that you might quarrel with me about whether it satisfies the notice
right.
And I didn't mean to say that, actually, but to your answer to my question is really midpoint of notice. That's
yeah, and I guess the third argument, and it's not the third issue, it's not presented here, is probation eligibility. I think I probably lose that argument, because otherwise,
This is not a statutory crime of violence. And when the pattern effect says you shall be sentenced in accordance with 406, and the title of that is mandatory sentencing, you know, I think maybe there's an argument out there now for today that, you know, maybe that isn't even right, that there may have been some original probation eligibility, and that's not presented here. But I see that as the three, there's no question it's the midpoint, elevating the bottom end sentence to midpoint presumptive. It's the notice requirements, and then it's the ineligibility for probation.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, if I could ask you just one last question, and this resurrects a point that you made earlier. Thinking about the Terry opinion and the comment that you made, that we pointed out that we call these per se crimes of violence because the nine offenses that were amended under this 1986 omnibus bill all had elements that looked a whole lot like the elements of the crime of violence sentencing. When you turn to sex assault on a child under the subsection 2, which I think lays out the class 3 felony versions of that offense, three of them actually do tend to overlap, use of force, threats, intimidation, and so forth, but the pattern offense looks like something different. And I'm just wondering, what was the timing of the addition of that provision, and how does it sort of square up with our definition of per se crime of violence?
Well, I think I can't answer the question in terms of timing of the pattern offense. I mean, there's been a lot of evolution of that offense and what it really means, and I've litigated it at the trial court level, but I'm sorry, I can't. But I agree with you. I mean, the point that I was trying to make is there aren't these overlapping elements that there are with the other offenses. And if the legislature had intended that all aspects of the 406 crime of violence sentencing would be applicable, they could have simply added that offense to the list of the crimes of violence. You could create a new subsection that says all pattern offenses. Bam, here you are, you're done, end of discussion. But they didn't do that. And so I don't know if that's a good answer because I don't have the hit that's in my brain. I don't have that historical development of a pattern offense. But what you can't do is just cherry pick parts of the 406, parts of the crime of violence statute that enhance the sentence without looking at the differences between sex offenses and other offenses. And secondly, what this court has held in Benzer, which I come back to as the roadmap, which is that bottom end sentence, the presumptive sentencing scheme still applies. And in this case, you don't go into the aggravated range unless there are extraordinary aggravating circumstances, and there aren't any. Sentencing court didn't think it appropriate, the post-conviction court didn't think it appropriate, and that's why the original sentence from the post-conviction court should be reinstated. And I'll reserve my 2 minutes.
And so the range should be 8 to 24 on the low end, according to your theory, non-extraordinary risk.
No, it's 8 to 12.
Okay, I'm sorry, 8 to 12. But yes. We disagree with you when you say it is the 8 to 24, and we agree with you on the 35B point, then this could be sent back and we could end up exactly where we are now, right? With the, right?
Well, I think that becomes a little complex, but I think Justice Coates' point in his first question to me was, hey, the court basically said, I'm going to impose my own sentence, and I'm going to impose a 12-year sentence. I think that's appropriate. Made me sad, made my client unhappy. But I don't think the Court of Appeals can go around imposing higher end sentences after the trial court has done what it's done and had jurisdiction to resentence. And there's no doubt that the 12-year sentence is a legal sentence.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ellison?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Again, my name is Catherine Ellison, appearing for the respondent, the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to start where counsel actually left off and begin with what was the fourth issue granted on cert. whether the statutorily permissible sentencing range for the Class III felony of sexual assault on a child as a pattern of abuse is an 8 to 24 lower term indeterminate sentence. I believe that it is, and to arrive at that range, I think that we have started discussing all the different historical pieces that are necessary, as well as the, as Justice Coates puts it, the complex scheme of interlocking statutes. These statutes are very difficult, and as the Court of Appeals says, they do tend to be ambiguous. When we're looking at the sexual assault on a child statute, and it requires sentencing in conformity with the crime of violence statute, it's a per se crime of violence. Under per se crimes of violence, all of the authority and this court's decisions show no distinction between per se crimes of violence and enumerated crimes of violence, unless we're looking to yet another statutory section that requires some other extraordinary sentencing, for example, the extraordinary risk sentencing. So a per se crime of violence is treated just as an enumerated crime of violence as defined in the crime of violence statute.
And you think that category still has viability with reference to a per se crime of violence?
I apologize, Justice Hobbs.
Yes, the per se crime of violence category. You think that still has viability?
I think it still applies. I think it certainly applies. There are these, as Justice Mark has detailed, in the 1986 omnibus bill, there were the 9 crimes that were set forth that were just determined to be so heinous and so abhorrent to the community that they required a greater sentencing range, an aggravated sentencing range. They were a graver crime, a graver offense against our community, and therefore the legislature felt it was in its best interest to allow for sentencing in accordance with the mandatory sentences for violent crimes statute.
Thank you.
Counsel, if I could just speak, I wonder if you have an answer to my question about the timing of the addition of that pattern provision in 405.
As far as the particular timing, Justice Marquez, I apologize. I don't have the specific timing. I do know that it was amended in 2002, so it existed as a pattern offense prior to 2002.
Like, I recognize that we've talked about these the fact that substantive offense over here requires sentencing in accordance with crime of violence sentencing makes this offense a per se crime of violence under our reasoning in Terry. But I'm struggling a little bit with how that applies here to this pattern offense. If our rationale in Terry really was based on the notion that the elements of those offenses really sort of overlapped with the crime of violence elements, if you will.
Well, and I think that the legislature did both offenses that kind of overlap the enumerated crimes of violence, but also looked at just these, as I said, these heinous crimes against our community. For example, committing a sexual assault on a child and continuing that behavior, that repeated behavior, is what makes it so aggravated and so heinous that the legislature saw it fit to kind of classify that in with these per se crimes of violence. So I don't think it's necessarily exclusively crimes that already kind of overlap with those enumerated crimes of violence in 18.1.3406. I think the legislature saw fit to expand that to also include these other very grave offenses, such as the pattern charges. And it's pattern, whether it's as a position of trust, it's a pattern offense, whether it's straight sexual assault on a child. I think that they looked at both of those and felt that that was important.
And all of that would make sense if, in fact, the pattern subsection actually existed at the time of Terry, because it would have been sort of roped in with that offense at that time. But I guess I'm just curious if this was just sort of lumped in later and then sort of hooked in to the crime of violence sentencing thereafter. Perhaps another question would be, and I don't mean to drag this out too long, are there other examples of offenses that really don't have overlap with the crime of violence sort of factors?
As far as the per se crimes of violence, I apologize to the court and to you, Justice Marquez, that I did not go through and parse out all of the different crimes of violence that are per se crimes of violence. So I can't answer that question.
That's fair, I'm a little bit off the week, so continue.
Sorry. That's quite all right, thank you. I think that the legislature simply intended to allow for aggravated sentencing and enhanced sentencing range on these grave offenses. In doing so, the crime of violence statute, subsection 1A, 18.1.3406 1A, for determinate offenses, which, as Council pointed out, sex offenses were determinate sentences prior to the enactment of the Colorado Sex Offender Lifetime Supervision Act in 1998. With a determinate sentence, the crime of violence statute is very clear that a sentence must be the midpoint of the presumptive to twice the maximum of the presumptive. And in enacting the Colorado Lifetime Supervision Act, the legislature did not intend to change that determinate sentencing structure or how that applies to particular offenses. Instead, it simply meant to overlay this idea of indeterminate or possible lifetime treatment, supervision in the community, and, as in the case of mandatory Department of Corrections sentences, possibly incarceration. I think that when you look at all of the statutes put together and constructed as a whole, you do end up with the indeterminate sentencing structure of 8 to 24 to life on the Class 3 felony of sexual assault on a child pattern of abuse. Because in the crime of violence statute itself, it refers back to the general sentencing statute, 18.1.3401, subsection 8. Which allows that if there is a crime of violence, the court, the trial court, the sentencing court, does not have to make specific findings of extraordinary aggravating circumstances if an offense is a crime of violence under the crime of violence statute. It uses that language under 18.1.3401 subsection 8 says if it's a crime of violence under 18.1.3406, the mandatory sentences for violent crimes. It doesn't say as defined in. And that's an important distinction. In all of the other statutory sections that require an enumerated crime of violence, in all of the other statutory subsections that say juvenile is entitled to a jury trial, or an offense is subject to extraordinary risk modification on the sentencing range, it requires that the offense be defined as an enumerated crime of violence in the mandatory sentences for violent crimes statute. In 18.1.3401, subsection 8, it says that the court can sentence in this extraordinary aggravated range without making extraordinary aggravating findings on the record if a charge is a crime of violence under the mandatory sentences for violent crimes. And I think that that's an important distinction. I think looking at the ambiguity here and turning to the rules of statutory construction, we have to look at all of these statutes all taken together. And when we do that, it does make sense that going from one to the next, we initially start with a presumptive range of 4 to 12. It becomes an indeterminate sentence offense because it's a sexual offense under 18.1.3-1004. It then becomes a per se crime of violence because of the statute defining the offense of sexual assault on a child as a pattern of abuse. Then looking at, going back to the crime of violence sentencing structure, we have the midpoint of the presumptive up to defendant's natural life, an indeterminate sentence with at least an 8-year sentence. This court has obviously structured that to provide a limit on that lower term, and that limit is twice the maximum of the presumptive. This court in Benzer did say that the court should look at extraordinary aggravating circumstances, as with any other case. And in this case, the extraordinary aggravating circumstances exist and do not need to be stated on the record because of that 18.1.3401 sub 8. Council has argued here today that perhaps the post-conviction court, not the post-conviction court and trial court, perhaps the post-conviction court had jurisdiction under the alternate theory that this was a 35A or the alternative 35B motion for reconsideration. And quite simply, that's not what the post-conviction court did. The post-conviction court in its order, both in its written order and in its ruling orally when it issued the new sentences, said a number of times, I find these sentences to be illegal, referring to the trial court's original two sentences. I find that they are illegal as a matter of law. And so the people are here today arguing that the post-conviction court did not reconsider the sentence. In fact, he believed that the original trial court sentences were illegal as a matter of law. He then misapplied the sentencing structure, came up with this range of 8 to 12 to indeterminate, and he sentenced the defendant to the maximum. The people are appealing the court's misapplication of those sentencing structures and believe that even if we are back, as Justice Hood pointed out, we may be, even if we are back before the post-conviction court, or perhaps it's another judge at this point, if we're back before that court on a 35B, the court may go ahead and use its discretion to reconsider the sentence and reduce it to a 12-year to life sentence. But this case has wider-reaching implications. I want to make sure, and the people need to make sure, that trial courts across the state, sentencing courts across the state, realize what the appropriate sentencing structure is on these offenses. These are grave offenses against children in our community, and there's a public interest in having that enhanced sentencing range. That has been explained here today.
Let me just interject.
Certainly.
Could it even be 8? Right, because there's overlap in positions 8 to 12, right? So you're saying 8 to 24, and he's saying 8 to 12.
Correct.
If there's a 35B after all the dust settles, then the court could even go back, well, wouldn't necessarily have to go from 16 to 12, could it all the way down to 8 on the 35B?
Certainly, the court could.
Not that you're advocating that, but right. I just, you know, we're a lot of jumping around here.
And I believe that the court would be able to do that. In its discretion, if the court felt it appropriate, it could, on a 35C following a final conviction, once this matter is resolved on review, it could reduce it as far as 8.
And you don't dispute the notion that that 35B reconsideration, 126 days from when the dust settles and all of this, is still available to the defendant?
I believe that it is available. Yes.
Thank you.
Once the conviction is final after review on appeal, I think that the defendant would have the ability to come back. So in this case, at the end of the day, is it making a huge bit of difference? I don't know. I don't know which court it would go back before. I don't know if it's the same post-conviction court. I believe it's actually been a rotation, so it would be a different judge yet again. So I think that the court could do that. But as a matter of law, I think that there needs to be a clarification on this point of what is the sentencing range on this Class 3 felony of sexual assault on a child as a pattern of abuse. Excuse me.
So if it goes back again, probation is a possibility or not?
Well, the mandatory sentencing requires the Department of Corrections sentence, but if by that point, given the time that we've been here, let's say that the court were to reduce the sentence to an 8-year sentence and it's a Department of Corrections sentence, perhaps the court could then reconsider and look at a probationary option. But I don't think that that's necessarily the issue before the court today.
I understand.
As far as whether or not, I'd like to address the Laban Delgado issue, whether or not an acknowledged illegality on one count renders the entire sentence illegal and thereby justifying correction or resentencing on all other counts. The people would submit that that is not, first, it's not what happened. It's not what's appropriate here in this case. The acknowledged illegality on count one, certainly the people acknowledged that it was not an extraordinary risk crime on count one. The trial court should not have sentenced to an indeterminate sentence of 8 years to life. And so the people believe that we needed to come back and have a resentencing on count one. But I think that the we're talking about multiple different things here, and we're all calling it the same thing. The cases all call it the same thing. Entitling the defendant to resentencing is appropriate. He is entitled to resentencing. And to the extent that the count two needs to be reissued on the MIT or resentenced on the MIT, I think it is appropriate to lump that in. But where we can compartmentalize, where this parse out the sentence into its discrete components here on count one and then on count two, I don't think that a defendant is required to be resentenced, the court is required to resentence the defendant on that second count if in fact the original sentence was legal. And I think that, yes, for purposes of post-conviction deadlines, for purposes of finality of the conviction, yes, the entire sentence is illegal if one portion is illegal. But that doesn't necessarily entitle the defendant to or mandate that the trial court resentence on all counts of conviction. I think.
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly, Justice Coates.
Well, two maybe. One, there is, as your opponent points out, a sentence in Leyva in which the court says, in which we say, we refer to if the sentence on one count is illegal, the entire sentence is illegal. How do you explain that unless it means, as your opponent suggests, that the sentence on all counts that were part of that judgment that were all tried at the same time are illegal.
I think as far as the Leyva case and that particular language, I think that at this point, if the sentence on one count here is illegal, the entire sentence and judgment of conviction as a whole cannot stand. I think that that's what the court is referring to in Leyva. I don't believe that that Leyva language then translates to mandating the resentencing court to looking at all judgments of conviction. I don't believe that the resentencing court, though it has to come back and have that resentencing hearing on that first count, I don't believe that it mandates that sentencing court to then resentence on each of those counts of conviction.
And does that come out to saying, even though a sentence on a particular count is illegal, that doesn't mean you get to be resentenced on that count?
No, I would believe you are certainly entitled, the defendant is certainly entitled to be resentenced on the illegal count. But any of the remaining counts of conviction that are legally imposed sentence, I don't believe they would be entitled under 35A to be corrected.
And I guess I'm sort of, that's kind of what I'm looking at, is given the language we used in the past and what's at issue now, how do we make the distinction between a sentence being illegal as a whole and yet some component of it not being illegal for purposes of being resentenced?
Well, I think that this court could go ahead and say where the one portion of the sentence is illegal, the entire case and judgment of conviction must be remanded for resentencing. Where the counts of conviction, the remaining counts of conviction have legally imposed sentences, I don't believe it. There's any mandate that the court must resentence. Now, if the court must resentence to correct an illegal sentence, it would then, the people believe that it would then resentence the one count that is the illegal, has the illegal component, and then resentence in accordance with the original sentencing structure. That's not what this court did, and it found instead that there were two illegal sentences here. So that it, and it looks like I may not be answering your question.
No.
So if I might, just a moment.
I'm listening intently.
Essentially, if there is one portion that can be compartmentalized, the entire sentence remains illegal and should go back to the court for resentencing. But I don't believe there's any mandate under 35A or any of the other language or the language in Leyva that requires specific resentencing on counts of conviction that had a legally imposed sentence in the first place. Again, for correction of the MIT, for allowing the sentence to stand as a judgment as a whole, for allowing a clean record for purposes of review, I think that it may be judicially prudent to go ahead and look at each of those sentences and say, for example, on this case, as the sentencing court would say, I find that the sentence on count one is illegal. I hereby resentence the defendant to an indeterminate term of 6 years to life on count one. I find that the sentence on count two, people's position, is a legally imposed sentence. I am resentencing the defendant.
So all you're saying is the trial judge on resentencing has discretion but doesn't have to.
Correct.
Reopen.
Correct, Justice Hobbs.
And you are saying that he has discretion, though, even if it was legally imposed. Is that what you're saying?
I think that the discretion comes under 35B, because the clear language of 35A is to correct an illegal sentence.
So you don't believe that the judge has discretion to resentence if on account that was not illegal?
Simply because of 35A, correct. I think if, as counsel has done in this case, the procedural stance of this case is that combined motion in the alternative, 35A and or 35B. If presented with that factual scenario, procedural scenario, the court can, under its discretion under 35B, review any other counts of
conviction. Let me follow up just one little bit on that. whatever Leyva meant in terms of illegality of the whole sentence, it's clear Leyva must have meant, though, that the judgment and conviction, which includes the sentence, is not final if any portion of it is illegal.
And I would agree with that.
Yeah. But so even if it's not final, that still wouldn't equate with allowing the judge to resentence. Is that what you're saying?
That's my argument. Yes, Your Honor.
So if I could just, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused by your position. You're saying there's no mandate to go back and, in this case, revisit legally imposed sentences, but there is discretion to look at the revisit those sentences, but only under 35B. So if there's no 35B motion before the court, we can't go back and sort of revisit the package?
Not discretionarily. I think it's a difficult... It's difficult to discuss because there are so many different ways that a trial court might craft a sentence. If it is, as you just used the phrase, a sentencing package as a whole, where, for example, a trial court might say, I believe that because of this, I want to give a sentence of 10 years for each count. And I think that the nature of this offense and the facts of this case and the procedural history and the criminal history of this defendant require a 20-year sentence on a two-count, 10-year, 10-year consecutive. That's a sentencing package where the trial court has indicated an intent to sentence to a 20-year term. If, in fact, it comes out that later the 10-year term on one of the counts is in excess of the statutory maximum, the trial court's intent is clear on the record, and then you might be looking at the entire sentencing package. But that's just off the cuff. I think that there is nothing that mandates looking at all the sentences when one of the sentences is illegal. And there's nothing that mandates reduction or modification of any of those remaining counts on conviction that had legally imposed sentences.
And I guess your main point here is that, at least in this situation, the only reason the other count two was revisited was because the post-conviction court deemed it to be illegal.
Correct.
Okay.
And when it did that, again, if the post-conviction court is looking at this under 35B, when the post-conviction court is looking at this under 35A, the primary issue is what is that sentencing range on that count two? What is that sentencing range of the indeterminate charge of sexual assault on a child as a pattern of abuse? It is a midpoint of the presumptive, 8 years, to twice the maximum of the presumptive, 24 years, to the defendant's natural life. It is, I believe that this court has the ability to clarify that statutory sentencing structure and explain, further clarify the legislature's intent to allow for that construction. I think looking at the defense's construction of the various different statutes and how they go together disregards the per se crime of violence subsection in the offense itself, disregards the 18.34.05.3 that requires sentencing in conformity with the crime of violence sentencing structures. I would ask that this court, if there are no further questions, would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have about a minute and a half.
Justice Hobbs, jumping back to your question about probation, that's what we were arguing for at our resentencing hearing. We had filed a combined 35A, 35B, and we thought we made a compelling case after 7 years of incarceration that probation was the appropriate sentence. And no matter how you define crime of violence, whether it's per se crime of violence or statutory crime of violence, there is that safety valve for a trial court to grant probation after a certain passage of time. It used to be 120 days, maybe it's 126 now under our rule of seven. The district attorney's position just doesn't make any sense in terms of a trial court's jurisdiction. What, we're gonna have one sentence in concurrent sentences declared illegal, there's no dispute it's illegal, yet the trial court, 7 years later, can't look at the defendant before the trial court and impose a new sentence and is stuck with a 16-year sentence imposed by a sentencing judge that clearly and conceivably misconstrued what the presumptive sentencing range was. We had a full-blown sentencing hearing. The sentencing court imposed a legal sentence of 12 years and said that's the appropriate sentence in this case, and the Court of Appeals became a sentencing court and ordered reinstated the 16-year sentence. So we ask that the judgment be reversed.
Thanks very much, Mr. Mueller. And you as well, Ms. Allison. We appreciate your arguments. The court is going to take about a 10-minute recess to allow the next case to set up. So we are in recess.